now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, our very special guest is Chris Turner, the producer, director of Don't Mention the Reptilians, the creator of the first ever conference dedicated to reptilian investigations. Chris has his own podcast channel now, The Last Transmission. I was privileged to be a guest in the recent past. So without any further ado, my good friend, Chris Turner, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show again.
No, it's great to be here, James. Great to get the invite. And as we talked about earlier, there's a lot to discuss. There's a lot going on in the world. There's a lot going on in the world of ufology, the world of, in fact, anything strange. There's a lot going on, isn't there? So there's lots to discuss, really.
Yeah, and, you know, to kick it off, where do you feel moved to, you know, start? Because like you said, there's so much going on.
Well, I wonder, and I know you touched on this when we in the brief chat just before we started, but I wonder if with all the activity, with everything that's happened in the last 2 or 3 years with various things, whether that has ramped up the increased sightings in the world of ufology and the world of cryptids, because certainly here in the UK at my end, we're getting a lot of reports of paranormal phenomena, that albeit it could be UFOs, it could be cryptids. I don't necessarily delve too much into the world of the supernatural, the hauntings and ghosts, poltergeist activity, but I would be curious. I'd be interested to speak to someone that is in that world just to see if it is ramping up there as well, because it seems to be, as you said, they're very curious at times. We know that at times on Earth when there's conflicts and other times of distress, like there is now all over the world, these guys are always seem to be around, aren't they? And increased sightings and increased reports of activity. So I wonder if there's a connection there. What do you think?
Well, yeah. If you go back to William Bramley's classic book, The Gods of Eden, which Barbie Bartholomew used to refer to as the Bible, right? He points out throughout that book, it's a chronology of supernatural / ET inspired events throughout history. And he clearly pointed out in that book, based on the medieval chronicles and going forward, that whenever there was periods of high distress, be it plagues, famine, wars, whatever the case may be, there was always an upsurge of signs and wonders in the air and the skies, and miracles in the skies and craft flying around and what have you. He talked about during prior to one of the plagues, eyewitnesses had seen humans, or what we would probably call humanoids, with what we would describe in our modern parlance as tanks on their backs, and they were spraying the crops with some kind of mist, right? So this is what was described, and them using the language of the vernacular of time, yep, and how we interpret it, it sounds to me like someone was spraying stuff on, you know, kind of doing like a Monsanto kind of thing, you know what I mean? So yes, throughout the ages, whenever there were wars, et cetera, there's been an upsurge in ET activity and ET sightings.
Well, I like the term you came up with, I think probably a long time ago, and you called it a frequency war. And I think that's absolutely, do you know, when I think about it over more and more, that's highly accurate in my opinion. This is a frequency war. Everybody must be feeling that, even subconsciously, they must be feeling that, because I'm feeling it now. And I don't really consider myself, you know, predominantly, I'm a filmmaker first, researcher and investigator. I'm not really as sensitive to any of this stuff, or not that I'm aware, but even I am can pick up on this. And I think you have to be, there's something wrong if people are not picking up now on this, because it's everywhere and I'm feeling it. And you know, we touched on it before, it does feel like there's a, it could turn, doesn't it? I don't know which way it's going to turn. I know which way I hope it's going to turn. But I do hope that there is some positivity out there and that we can drive that change in the right way. Because I used to think that sort of thinking was a little bit, I used to think it was a little bit new age, to be honest. But the more I've researched that, the more, when I got into this, I was listening to guys like Bill Cooper, David Icke, even Greg Braden, who's not necessarily in ufology, but he's a great researcher. And he used to talk about that 20 years ago when I was listening to that kind of information. I never really bought into it, but now I've had time to digest it and research into it more and even meet people that practice that sort of thing. It's absolutely real. And with them absolutely overloading us with this fear and negativity, that proves to me that they cannot have us in a constant state of positivity, can they? For any period of time. You know, they give us Christmas and the holidays. They might give you a couple of weeks of positivity where there's absolutely no negative press. There's nothing horrible going on in the world. There's no conflict. But it doesn't last very long, does it? And at the moment, it is constant. It is nonstop. It's COVID. Now it's conflict. Then it's the carbon war. And onward this thing goes, because I think at the start of the COVID thing, they saw how easily we as a, you know, as a population could be manipulated, not us as individuals, obviously, but fear, as you've said it many times, is very powerful. It's a very powerful emotion, and they know that. How we overcome that, you know, there are those of us, I think that what COVID and that whole crisis has created is that divide. Certainly over here in the UK, I think there's a clear distinction now between the sides, which is a shame, really, because I think obviously all of us have lost friends one way or another through this. I mean, you know, you can lose your friends in the world of ufology very easily over something very minor. But when something like this happens, you know, in let's call it the real world, it's not the real world, but in the stage world, that has divided a lot of people and a lot of good people as well. And I'm still hoping that some of those people will see the light. I think they will. I think some people that I never expected to see what's going on. And it's not just the whole virus thing. This is big. You've said it before. This is bigger than that. This is something that's been in the planning for thousands of years. So we are effectively, you know, when I used to hear people like yourself, you've said it, David Icke, Alex Jones has said it in the past, that we're at war here. I never really saw it before because I wasn't that deep into it at that stage. But now you see it. I can see it. There is a war on here. Whether that transcends into, you know, other dimensions or outside of Earth realms, which I get the feeling that that's been also going on for a long time. I know you've talked about that. A lot of researchers have talked about that. But that's kind of how it feels.
We wrestle not with flesh and blood, battling, paraphrasing, wickedness in high places, spiritual planes, very low spiritual planes, but also high spiritual planes, because this conflict transcends the fourth and the fifth dimension. It continues at least to the sixth dimension and beyond. So what we're seeing with the frequency war, and I'm glad you brought that up, the way they're cranking everything up now with the increased frequency modulation, with the weaponized rain, the weathered weaponry, et cetera, those of us who've been around long enough, like you and I, Chris, we can encase ourselves, if you will, in a bubble, like a sanctuary bubble. And it's very much like the resistance fighter, the undercover operative in Nazi-occupied France, Europe, World War II. You're just mixing in with the rest of the population. Sometimes you got to wear a mask because you want to look like them, right? And you don't want to engage in deep conversations and all this other stuff. You just want to be literally the gray man, just blend in the crowd. No one gives you a second look. Because we're at the point now, you talked about the casualties that we're already incurring for some time now. With the onset of winter, northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, the frequency modulation, the autoimmune enhanced dependency, we're going to see a bigger die-off in the near future. So whereas in the past, and you're old enough to understand this, Chris, some of our younger viewers don't have a context, but we went through and lived through the AIDS epidemic, right? Where Robin Williams is coming on TV and saying, you know, if we don't do something about this, it'll wipe out the whole planet. Well, it didn't wipe out the whole planet, right? But they got a lot of people into thinking that it was going to wipe out the planet. And so back then, and I fell for it too, oh, who's got it? Who doesn't have it? Ooh, that person's been sick for a while, right? Oh, that person, different orientation, been sick for a while. What does that mean, right? But now it's like, you got the poker face, okay. Double treated, triple treated, boosted up the yin-yang, all these people around you. And what do we hear constantly? This person's sick, that person's sick. Oh, but if I didn't get the treatments, you know, I'd be a lot worse. So the doctors tell me, right? So you got the poker face on. This is spiritual warfare manifesting on the physical plane. And again, it's a marathon. We get to the finish line, however we get there, without hopefully compromising too much of ourselves or souls in the process. But we get to the finish line somehow, some way, however long it takes. We survive, we win. And we've got options at that point. So.
Yeah, well, the analogy of the blue pill, red pill has never been so blatant, has it? You know, I wasn't sure I was ever going to experience that in such a way, but yeah, that, you know, amongst my group of friends and acquaintances, yeah, that, I mean, that's been, it's been hard to watch, actually, and also hard to control. I mean, you're probably a little bit more experienced than me in that regard, where you've learned to control your reactions to it, I would imagine. That's difficult to do, isn't it? It's sort of difficult not to just splurt all this all your emotions out and your feelings out in regards to it, because, and also it's hard to do it without sounding like you're coming across as though you're better than them, as though you're on this soapbox and you're preaching to people, look, we told you this would happen, and all that kind of thing. And ego obviously plays a huge part in this, because I think that's one of the things that is really stopping or slowing the resistance down, actually. People just aren't willing to, after 2 years of being told by so-called crackpots that what would happen, that even now they're not willing to back down at all. It's crazy. They're not willing to take a U-turn. They're not willing to say sorry. And that is a sad state of affairs when someone that you've been friends with or acquaintances with, even it might be a family member, you know, because I know friends that have lost family members over this and other things going on in the world, just for a matter of a difference of opinion. And that's crazy, when, especially when it's so blatant now. You know, now I think Ike's terminology is that, you know, they've come in the room and the door is shut behind them. And I think that's a great analogy. You know, the cat's out of the bag. They're no longer actually afraid of blatantly telling you what the agenda is. They're not bothered. This Klaus Schwab guy, they're quite happy, actually, to let you know, because it's part of the agenda to let you know. Whether that comes around to I know you've discussed the karmic loop before, whether that escapes this karmic trap, but that they let us know and we decided not to do anything about it, I don't know. That's certainly how it feels. You know, we're being given an opportunity here. Obviously, we're up against it, because everything you say, everything you write is censored. Everything that the public, that are not necessarily in our sphere, everything they see is controlled. It's all propaganda. It's managed. So in some respects, I do see that what they're seeing in their world is completely different to what we're seeing. And, you know, I appreciate that. But, you know, sometimes when you've got minor celebrities, we'll call them, actually backtracking and saying something decent for a change that actually supports what's really going on in the world. And even then, Even journalists that are backtracking, scientists are backtracking. It's not enough, is it? It's just, and it is that, well, I'll just run with the herd because I feel safer here. And that's not going to last forever, is it? But yeah, we'll just stick with it. I mean, it's took a year or two to sort of develop the, not the strength, but the, I don't know, the sort of resolve to not react, because in the end, what it does do is have a negative effect on you, and it starts bringing your energy and frequency down, doesn't it? So yeah, in the end, I think what we have to do is what we're doing now, and that is conversing amongst ourselves, making plans going forward. And also, I don't think it's great to get caught up in this stuff anyway. You know, I think after I was doing months of just intense sitting down and trying to find out what was going on and researching this stuff. And all it actually did was, yes, it arms you with knowledge, but it also, again, it drains you. It's tiring, because all the time you're doing that, you're also in conflict with friends or colleagues or acquaintances trying to open their eyes to this sort of stuff. But now I think we've all, as I said earlier, the divide is there for all to see. And I think most of us have chosen our side, and I'm happy with my choice.
Well, the lines are clearly drawn now. Mm. We know, I mean, I'm to the point where, as far as bureaucrats and medical practitioners, what have you, and anyone, any cog, however small, that makes up this machine, right, this edifice, I'm already differentiating between, oh, that person is a human and that one's not. Because if this Wetico consciousness, this demiurge consciousness animates them to either go along, to be oblivious, to be confrontational and intimidating and boorish, because they've been empowered just that much, right? Clearly, the spirit, if you will, whatever is manifesting through them, animating them, it's not the same as what's animating us, right? Because by now, in all the key professions, there are countless people by this point who have seen over and over and over again the baneful effects of the media, of the medical advice, let's say, right? I'm not just talking about ambulance drivers, but, you know, everyone within the first responder, all that stuff. They've seen enough by now. And if at this point they're, well, you know what, I need a job, got to keep a roof over my head, blah, 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 right? If at least consciously they're saying that to themselves, well, yes, that's a different consciousness than I'm accustomed to hanging around. And I don't hang around people like that. I will be cordial to them if I have to be around them. If I have to interact with them, you know, I'll be cordial with them, and I'll listen to them when they're, you know, saying these nonsensical things. But educate them, never, because I'm undercover. I'm in my role as, you know, James Bartley, right? And if they're in their little slice of the multiverse, believing and acting on all this Luciferian deception, we have to start looking at like attritional warfare at some level. How many of them die off compared to how many of us die off? I mean, in stark terms, that's the way how I look at it. Now, fortunately, it saddens me that people that I know and care about and love, they've heeded the call of the herd, right? But at the same time, those people that I know, you know, the key players in this effort to reclaim this planet and, you know, our share of the universe, enough of us have, you know, stuck to our guns, quite frankly. So, you know, from your standpoint over there, too, what are you seeing amongst the younger generations? Because I'm always interested in who's supposedly coming back and backing us up. You know, who's got our six? What does it look like from your perspective over there?
Yeah, it's difficult because I don't have that much to do with, you know, my kids are in between those ages. So I have had the chance to be around a few, and it's a mixed response, I'll be honest. A lot of them should be just be living their lives now, shouldn't they? So I can understand they're not interested in politics, and that's normal, if you know. But the ones that are actually do see it. But what's sad to say is that they're conforming because they want to go on holiday, for example, or they want the what they would class as luxuries in their life, which are actually rights, in my opinion. But there you go. Yeah, so it's a mixed response. I wouldn't say it's not negative in any sense. You know, I don't get the sense that they're falling for this, if that's the right terminology. As you say, if this is spiritual, I don't know how that's going to manifest itself in these younger generations, because they're more than anyone now. I mean, we think our generation and the generation above us are being bombarded now with news and media, but it's the young people that are actually being bombarded with some horrible stuff. You know, you've really got to keep your eye on what, because this agenda is multifaceted, as you've talked about before. And this whole transhumanism angle now is really coming to the forefront, isn't it? This whole, seems to me that the whole scientific religion, the whole technocratic, this sort of world of medicine, technology and science now is just taking over, isn't it? And they're bombarding the youngsters with this. And of course it's all very attractive, and it's, you know, it's all sold to them in a very sexy way, which is the way that this stuff is done. But the effects of it, I mean, even look at the guy, who was the guy from Apple, the guy that died of cancer a few years back. Do you remember what he said? I can't remember his name now, but he wouldn't let his kids go on the tablets, would he?
He wouldn't let them
anywhere near that sort of technology.
Yeah, he didn't let them on computers.
Yeah, not only that, I can see it in myself. I can see it. You know, when I'm sat there holding my phone at night scrolling, and obviously all this stuff, it's all subliminal, isn't it? It's constantly going in, and even worse so with the youngsters, because now they're being given all sorts of mixed messages about the family unit. They're trying to, you know, I'm not a huge fan of religion, but I can see the benefits of some religion. At least they're united on some front, and the values are there. With all this stuff going on at the moment, there are no values. Certainly no values come from anything remotely good that I can see.
It's the Babylonian influence, with all the gods and serpent gods and reptilian gods, etc., pushing that whole mindset is what's going on too. So it's the ghost in the machine aspect. You talked about the addiction of digital devices. We know, you and I, we've spoken to people who've got that etheric third eye vision, second sight thing going on. They see things coming out of the computer screens. They see like little sculler, spidery things, or octopus looking beings, or other things coming out of the computer screens. We know that there's an AI mind reading aspect to it too, because so many of us have just been thinking about some product or a service, not even verbalizing the thought. Next thing you know, an ad pops up, right? That just shows you their computing power. That it's already quantum computing. That they're far beyond that already, right?
Yeah.
So when it's at that level, and now we're talking about the treatments and the nanoprocessing operating systems, little Hydra thingies, graphene, et cetera, we're talking about, and of course, knowing them the way they are, because they're intergalactic, interdimensional gangsters. Okay, if you want to look at it that way,
yeah, right? That's a good way of putting it.
They're gangsters. You know, think about the oligarchs in Ukraine that owned all the oil companies and the pipelines and everything else. Right? It's a similar dynamic where they take out patents because they always saw the human race, their genetically dumbed down, de-evolved variant of the human race before all this recent madness. But now, because they're rolling out all these treatments, they say, oh, wait a minute, this is going to change them genetically. Let's take a patent on them because they're no longer flora and fauna anymore. You know, this dumbed down primate kind of creature that we've already created. Now we're going to like split them off, make an offshoot of them. And so we're already seeing, Chris, that this variant race being created with all these babies that somehow survived, you know, their mother's ordeal and didn't get miscarried in the process. They're being born, a lot of these kids, but they're radically different. And they all, because of the placental connection, they absorb all of the, those nano-processing systems, graphene, hydrogel, everything else. So we're literally seeing before our eyes a whole new variant subspecies being created.
Yeah, do you know what? I was thinking yesterday, I was in a conversation with someone, and it came up about, you know, how do we get into this genre? I mean, obviously you had experiences, but I never had that. But what I did have is, and it's always the question, isn't it, as a host of a podcast or someone into, you know, as an investigator, it's like, how did you get into this thing? And I've always wondered what differentiates one person from another, because I still find it fascinating that we can talk about things that are changing the world. We can talk, take what's happened in ufology in the last 3 years, 4 years. And your everyday person isn't even batting an eyelid about it. They're not even, in fact, some of them haven't even noticed. Something that is about to change the world, you know, if it ever is. I mean, this is the start of it, publicly anyway. But I've always wondered what makes someone interested and not interested. When does that connection, is the connection from birth? You know, when are those threads cut? Are they cut throughout, you know, your sort of youth, and as you drift into other things, that sort of, you lose a connection to spiritual matters, to I don't know, just to I just don't understand why people are not more interested in this stuff. And I get there's a lot of distractions. I get that family and work and stress and the world of celebrity, which is always going to be one of the techniques that they use, isn't it? Akin to the gladiators back in the day, you know, entertainment and gambling and all the rest of it is a distraction, and music and entertainment. I see that, I get that, but still, I see people very, very interested in the world of movies, for example, that contain a lot of the information that we're talking about. But when you would then try and engage in a conversation about that very stuff, they're not interested. I find it fascinating. It's very similar.
It's a bizarre dichotomy because, I mean, I've been around full-grown adults. I mean, they're younger than us, but they're adult males. And like in any other society, at least in the old days, be looking at him, okay, technically he's an adult in this stage of, you know, technological development, in this stage of societal evolution. That's an adult male. But they're all into all the video games, and they're all into the Disney Netflix movies, a lot of them, especially all these spin-offs of Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
And clearly there's good guys, there's bad guys, there's the Empires and the Rebels. And invariably, of course, generally from a movie-watching perspective, they're for the Rebels in the Star Wars scheme of things, right?
Yeah.
But in actual fact, in a real world scenario, they would be part of the staff on board of the Death Star, right? Because they lack that divine intuitive connection that should tell them there's something wrong here. There's something going on. I can't quite put my finger on it. But yes, it's the de-evolution. It's the end. So many of them are computer geeks too, and you know, video game geeks. So that's yet another example or means to which these entities can jump in. Somebody told me, and they were connected. I can't remember who it was, but they were connected in some way with the video gaming industry. And this guy told me that a lot of these game characters that are like swinging around these big battle axes in these combat games, they're accurate as much as possible, accurate depictions of various kinds of demons and entities, you know, down to the folklore of all these different, you know, cultures, some of them quite obscure. And so they wind up being in all these video games. Kids play them. Kids choose to have these demons as their avatars and like play them, right? And then it goes beyond that, because some of those kids, and we're talking also adults, they start having nightmares of those same video game characters who they've played coming after them with battle axes and stuff at night, because they didn't realize that there were real entities. And see, that brings us, you know, to the key question that I've always had, and I find a way to ask this of everyone at some point, is you, Chris Turner, made the first ever professionally done documentary series on reptilians, right? Don't mention the reptilians. And there have been other documentaries kind of put together in the Thrive vein, if you know what I mean. And, you know, a lot of a lot of historical context, et cetera, et cetera. But you went a step further. You filmed interviews with all these people that had reptilian experiences, people that are experts in our field. What got you to the point, Chris, that you realized that, you know what, I got to do something about this reptilian subject, because it's left a mark on me, and I feel that there's something to it. Could you take our viewers through that process, how that came about?
I think it did leave a mark on me. I think I've said this before in previous interviews, that I saw an interview with David Icke, and he was on some TV show here in the UK years and years ago, a long time ago. I would have only been, I would have probably only been about 16, possibly. So that's a while back. But that stayed with me, and he and the reaction to what he was saying, you can imagine what the reaction was by the main, this is mainstream TV. And I think this is obviously after the Wogan thing. So that had already followed him around for a few years. But something about what he said just stuck me. And I don't actually know why. I have no clue why that stuck with me. I'd been interested in ufology, always. And as I said earlier, I don't know why. I don't know what differentiates one person's interest from another. I just don't know. It's got to be something spiritual. That's the conclusion I'm coming to. It's more than life influence. It's more than your surroundings. It's more than that, in my
opinion. I think it was pre-existing, because some of us could be born in a family that are completely oblivious to any of this.
Absolutely.
Outright hostile to it. But somehow the light comes on for some of us.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I think at that moment, I think the light was on, obviously, before that interview, but the light stayed on, and because it was many years after, it was, in fact, it was almost 20 years after that. I think I started, like a lot of people, Kerry Cassidy and Bill Ryan were doing a lot of work back then, some decent stuff back then. And as I said, I'd always been looking at, because YouTube was amazing, actually, about 10 years, 15 years ago, it was an amazing place. Obviously there's a lot of crazy stuff out there, and there still is, but there's a lot of fascinating stuff out there. And I was just sucking all this stuff up. But the reptilian thing would come up every now and then. It would come up, and you had your key guys that were talking about this stuff, people like Alex Collier. I remember watching the Alex Collier interview and that phrase that he said, you know, about the reptilians. No one wants to talk about it. And go to hell, I'm going to talk about it. And that again, I think it was that watching that interview particularly that stuck with me as well. And then obviously I got onto your stuff. And I thought, what is this? It's almost like, I don't know. It was almost like people were walking around this subject. They just didn't want to look at it. They just wanted to shield themselves from it for some.
There was like some kind of archetypal deep seated dread about the very subject, but please continue.
Yeah, no. Phraseology is not that great, probably a bit early for me. But yeah, what I'm trying to get at is that people were sort of just completely blatantly ignoring it. And even when I tried as an interviewer, I would try and get them on the subject. I'd meet these guys and we'd be talking about a book they'd released, or we'd be talking about some research they'd done. And then I would gently just introduce it into the conversation, and it would be you would see the walls come up. We're not going there. We're just not going in there. That sort of response was, well, there's got to be more to this. And I think intuitively I knew there was more to this anyway. And it was at that point, there were a few YouTube documentaries out at the time. I think one of them was called Plausible Points for the Reptilian Case. I don't know whether you ever watched that. Great. Very, very amateur in its production, if you like. But I spoke to the guys that did that. One of the guys that did that. And that took a while to put together, but I think he did a brilliant job, and I'd love to see him.
I thought it was brilliant. I thought they did an outstanding job.
Absolutely. I'd love to see what he could do with a little bit of money, because he clearly knows his stuff. And I think that it was the ancient connection, the ties to our ancient archaeology and the ancient alien thesis and all the rest of it, that then and serpent worship and all this stuff just came together. And then you had the djinn. I was reading about the djinn because at one time I was going to do a film on the djinn, and still may do, because there's a connection with that. So yeah, all that stuff. It was just too attractive proposition, if you like. I couldn't not do it. It was almost like, why is no one doing this? Even when I met David Icke, I went to interview David, and I just said, I know you did the interviews with Credo Matois and all that stuff. But I actually said to him, why have you never produced something specifically on this? And I don't know what he said, actually. I mean, he's very busy, and he's trying to do so many things at once. That was probably why. And I think sometimes what David's message is more, and was always more than the reptilian thing. And I think he feared that if he focused specifically on that, that would probably undo a lot of the spiritual consciousness work that he was doing as well.
I think that was a good move on his part.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see why he did that. And as a filmmaker, I can get away with that move. It doesn't affect me in any like the same way, because the feedback from the film has been very good. Not its production, but the actual people looking at this stuff going, wow, I didn't realize that. And they've gone on to do more research. So, and obviously now that we're at a point now where part two is in production, and this is where I want to get into that ancient serpent worship and all this. And I want to do effectively what the Plausible Points for the Reptilian Case did. But I want to bring in some experts on that. I mean, you're in it, obviously, but you've met Pierre. You've had Pierre Sabak on the show. You know how intense this guy.
Absolutely brilliant. The guy is like a living encyclopedia of the ancient texts in a variety of languages.
Yeah, I mean, the book that he wrote. Where is it? I've got that book somewhere. Where is it? It's called I've got it up there. It's called Holographic Culture. That's an immense book. It's an incredible book, and that book takes some reading, I can tell you.
Yes, I was just looking back there. I have it back there. It's dense reading, and dense from the perspective of that there's so much information condensed in a single paragraph. I mean, you got to plow through it. But he backs everything up, though.
Yeah, when I was reading, I've interviewed Pierre, but I'm going to have to do the interview again, because in all honesty, I just wasn't prepared, because it's difficult as a filmmaker. I walked into Pierre's research not really understanding the depth of it. You know, you can ask one or two simple questions, but then, as you know, this is layered, and Pierre Sabak gets into very, very deep layers of his research and his study that's took 15 years to put this out. And I actually think but the plan is that I know you wanted to get Pierre to get his research out there. I still think more can be done to get Pierre's research out there. I think once people read this book, I think it's gonna change their life. I think anyone that doubted the serpent reptilian thing. I think they're going to do a complete U-turn if they can take the book in, because I think the size of the book and the depth of the information turns a lot of people off. I know from people, I've recommended the book. People have got back in touch with me and said, Chris, I can't take this in. It's too much. There's too much information.
There's a lot of information. If they take it a chapter at a time, just break it down into bite-sized chunks, augment their readings with watching some of his interviews, right? Because he points out like Watcher and all these different terms that have come down, Archon, all these different terms that we take for granted in our field, that there is a connection with the serpent, saurian, lizard, reptilian civilizations. Every single one. And he talked about the flying boats and all that, and it all relates to flying craft, flying saucers, what we would call UFOs. It's all there. We just have to, and he's done us the courtesy, the yeoman's work of interpreting what the ancient texts said in ways that we can understand, that they were basically describing in their own terms all these craft, all these beings, all these reptilian creatures that controlled human society, basically.
Yeah, and it's the communion, if you like, of these two groups and the creation of the Adamic man, which was fascinating. I mean, I still got to try and get my head around it. I think effectively he talks about the ancients' fascination with Orion, doesn't he? And that this meeting of minds, if you like, took place on Orion, and the creation of the Adamic man took place on Orion. Obviously, I think you have the serpent gods, or what he calls the seraphim in Sirius, and then you've got the Pleiadians, and they I think they were at war for a long time, and then decided to come together to create this, if you like, this man, if you like. Whether that, in what state man was at that point, Pierre, we'll go into depth about that. But in an 80-minute documentary, it's difficult to condense Pierre's research and do it justice. That's what I was struggling with, because me and Pierre sat for 3 hours. I think we sat for 3 hours and we did a few Skype sessions. And obviously I go into the interview and I start breaking this information down, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get this across in a way that does it justice, that does 15 years of etymology and iconography and all the stuff that's in this book that he's done justice? So that's where I'm at now with Pierre. I think we're going to have to meet again and get our heads together in a creative way, actually, to try and put this information in across in the right way.
I'll watch and listen to his interview on my show, because I'm sure he dropped some mega nuggets there. But again, it's, he gets into this flow and he really points out what the texts themselves say. When you interpret it correctly, what do the chroniclers, ancient chroniclers, whatever language, Aramaic, whatever the case may be, what are they saying in their own terms? And then when he lays it out to you, I think that if we can get him to like talk about, okay, that particular ceremony or whatever they're describing there, could you elaborate more on that? It's like, what do they seem to be describing, right? And what they're describing is this creation of these hominoid races, like, we've been discussing hominid, hominoid. The creation of these cosmologies, these essentially religions, eventually, for purposes of control and what have you. So, and also what I took away from his research also is how ancient man, they took it for granted that these beings were around and they did all this stuff, and they occasionally walked among us, and occasionally and off quite often in our history, we bowed down in fealty and worship to them because of the awesome powers that they wielded, right? And that comes out a lot in the ancient texts. It's like they behold, they show up and they do all this thing. Everyone is like fear stricken, falls on their knees, You know,
yeah.
And if
yeah.
anyone wants to get an idea of what I'm talking about in a TV show cinematic sense, they should watch all, you know, a lot of the old episodes of Stargate SG-1, because Pierre Sabbach, in many ways, I liken him to a real life version of Dr. Daniel Jackson, right? Dr. Daniel Jackson knew all these different languages. He, you know, he would jump through Stargates, and he knew about the origins of all these different gods worshipped in the days of yore, right? And they were all aliens, right? And who were the protagonists, the bad guys, in the first several seasons of Stargate SG-1? It was these aliens who were taken up as hosts by reptilian beings, snake entities, a bird under their necks, took them over, and then presented themselves to humans as gods, right? And then they warred amongst themselves. They were system lords. Right? They divided up the galaxy the same way the mafia divided up, you know, different parts of the world, different parts of America, right? So it ties into a lot of the stuff that we were talking about. Pierre is the more academic side, but he's not pure academia either, because he's probably shared with you, he's had some interesting mystical experiences too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how, whether that, again, it's a bit like, I suppose it's a bit like the David Icke syndrome, I suppose. I don't know how deep Pierre would want to go into that, in a sense that it would might undo his, the actual academic work that he's done. I'm not saying that he does feel like that. I'm just wondering, you know, would that be the case? And if it would be the case, I couldn't appreciate why he wouldn't want to do it. But yeah, certainly. And actually, off topic, you can talk to Pierre Sabbach about anything. Any of this stuff that we discussed earlier, and any of the certainly in ufology, just bring ufology in the world of cryptids, he can connect it through his research. He can connect all this stuff and put the pieces together. Whereas someone like me, I find that very, I mean, I can do it in my head, I can do it, but I can't necessarily put it over in an academic way, almost in a scientific way. I mean, because this book is like a paper. This is like a scientific paper. He even said to me, you know, you get anyone to read this and look through it, and I can debate a lot of people on what I'm saying here, or, you know, certainly, you know, it's absolutely plausible what he's saying. So yeah, I mean, so Pierre Sabbach for part two was an absolute must. And then obviously part two, we've got a friend of ours, David Eckhart, who's also in part two, and David's pictures and video and his experience speak for themselves, because he is a guy having amazing experiences, some of them on camera. And that doesn't happen a lot. You know, I think in the 15, 16 years I've been doing this, and the amount of images I get sent, certainly since I got into the world of cryptids, you know, I can, on one hand, I can pick the images that are, and the bits of video that are worth anything, or that look, you know, like decent enough proof. But then you got David Eckhart's. All right, yes, he's took thousands of images, but some of those images and pieces of video are incredible. Then with his personal experiences, not only him and his wife. You know, it's just often it's David in the interviews, but sometimes his wife will speak up as along with him, to say that this is absolutely legit. And there are other researchers that have been to his house that I know that have said this is absolutely going on.
He described something that was extremely obscure. One of my good friends, Luana Smith, who I spent many days and nights in her reptilian infested house in the high desert of Southern California, she said she awoke one morning to find her front yard covered with earthworms. And David is the only one other person I've met that said the same thing. He said, I woke up one morning and the whole field, the whole front yard was covered with earthworms. It's like, geez, where have I heard this before? See, such an obscure thing. And what do they both have in common? Lots of reptilian experiences. Lorena had a reptilian base right practically beneath her house. She took us and some colleagues of mine, you know, to a point up on a mountain, which was directly above where this joint reptilian human base was. Right, military base, and some of us unfortunately were taken against our will into the same facility. But anyway, the point of relevance is David somehow experience the exact same thing. I mean, who would make up such a thing? I wake up and I found my front yard covered with earthworms.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, what I've experienced in the last like 15, 16 years of interviewing people is that you can see in his mannerisms, you can see in the nonchalant way that he actually just talks about this stuff, because it's become so normal to him. And you don't get that with a lot of witnesses. You know, often with a witness, it will be a one-time deal, a thing, or, you know, it'll be every few years. But with David, this is constant. This is ongoing. And he can prove it. And as you said, there are some very obscure, and actually the way he describes these, some of the reptoids, if you like, that he's dealing with, almost more frog-like, he describes them, doesn't he, some of these guys? So he doesn't actually...
Some of them are more like almost amphibian in appearance.
That's right, yeah. And I thought that was interesting because I've never heard that before. I've never heard that.
One of my friends back in the old San Diego days, she was taken to the moon on an ET experience. And she said one of the beings she encountered there, and there's probably more than one type, was this 4.5 foot tall amphibian frog-like being, right?
Yeah.
It was there amongst a bunch of other different aliens. But it stuck out with her because when she looked at it, she said that was like a frog being, right?
Yeah, it's a... And when I say that, I don't want people to think that we're talking about a giant frog here. We're talking about I think the way it looked, and so this is a bipedal reptilian amphibious type looking being. I was fascinated by that, the way he described it, and then some of the other experiences that he's talked about portals just opening up in the room. Why he's just sat there, and this thing just opens up. And he's looking into this portal. And I remember him telling me one story where he looked into it and it looked like a set of his house. It looked like someone had recreated his house in this other place that he was looking into. And I thought, what is going on there? So, I mean, that's got all sorts of connotations, just that story alone. So again, to not feature David Eckhart in a film about reptilians would be, you know, it would be a crime. So David's also going to feature in that. And obviously with the last couple of years, that has really sort of derailed the progress that I was making on that film. Cause at one time I was motoring along. But as you know, things happen and can derail a project really quickly, especially with the way I do things, because I have to juggle projects. I often have two films on the go along with work, which is also in which I also create mini documentaries for a job for another company. So to fit all that in and try and get all that out there, it's a bit of a task. So what I decided to do is then start a podcast to make it even harder for myself. So, yeah, probably not the wisest move, but the podcast thing that I do now, The Last Transmission, it's just something that I've wanted to do. Obviously I've been watching your show for years. So, and a couple of other friends that have got podcasts, and it's something I've always wanted to do. I got into that, and David, I'm going to get David Eckhart on the show very soon. So yeah, now that this seems to have calmed down for the meantime, that's going to allow me this year, I'm going to be very, very busy this year with certainly We Don't Mention 2 and Elusive 2, which is the cryptid, the film to the sequel to Elusive, which is the cryptid documentary.
Yeah, the time we got left for this first segment, tell us about the cryptid aspect. What's been going on, the cryptid activity in the UK in the recent past? And, you know, please.
Yeah, well, the cryptid thing, obviously, when I got into the, we'll call it the British Bigfoot, it's actually called the Wood Wars or the Wild Man here in the UK. That was another steep learning curve, because it was a bit of, it shouldn't have been, but it was a bit of a surprise to me that there was a lot of cases. And when I say a lot of cases, we're talking now, some researchers say between 2,000 and 5,000 cases here, which is incredible, really, considering the size of Britain. And when you then consider that how many people are even going to report this stuff, that then becomes a very interesting subject. And I've found, obviously, since getting into it and since releasing Elusive, that has now brought more witnesses out of hiding, if you like, because it's become a bit normalized in a sense. It's never going to be normal, but actually talking about this because of the amount of podcasts out there now where people are just having general conversations now, I think they're feeling a lot more relaxed about this paranormal, everything in the paranormal world now. Even the mainstream's taking in more of the paranormal. We're seeing more paranormal shows. We're seeing more shows on ufology, more ghost hunting shows. It's almost like there's a fascination around it again, a bit like there was when the X-Files came, you know, in the 90s, that massive fascination with this subject again, which is great. Really, I mean, it's possibly part of the game, but where, as you said, take the positives and the negatives. Don't you know? If you can find a positive in it, then take it. And I think it's good that everybody's more relaxed and talking about this thing. But certainly with the cryptid accounts, there are a lot of accounts coming in on a daily basis. Sometimes with some researchers that certainly guys at the British Bigfoot Research Foundation. Guys at the Winter Hill, there's a group called the Winter Hill team that take accounts from a place called Winter Hill that's only about 8 miles from here. And I've investigated that place last year. Two of my friends were looking into some sheep killings up there. I think there was something like, I think it was about 17 sheep in the end were being killed.
How they were killed or what, you know, the investigation?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the interesting part of it, because I think given the time of year, I think some of the kills, after I'd had a chance to look into this properly, because it's difficult, certainly that time of year, it's the snow on the ground. It's difficult to research up there because obviously some of the kills are under snow and they weren't being found till, you know, after the thaw, if you like. So it was difficult to place a time on these things. And the wounds were varied on them. Some of them did and could have been dog attacks. So, I think we could rule one or two out for dog attacks, potentially. Others were a little bit more strange than that. I personally think it might have been a big cat up there. And then we had a sighting from two people of what they classed as a dog man. And the two guys, the two friends of mine that were researching this were up there, and they also said that they caught a glimpse of something that they thought wasn't a big cat. Let's just say that. They weren't sure what they saw, but this thing appeared to be stalking them. Now, I wasn't there. I can only take their word for that. But these two guys, they're pretty straight-up guys. They've not really got any reason to make this stuff up. They're not profiting from any of this, much like all of us aren't. They just want to get the information out. And they've done some really good research up there and found a lot of witnesses, because Winter Hill is a very strange place. It's a little bit, the more I look at it, it's not as active as Bempton, the place that Paul Sinclair investigates on the east coast of England, the northeast coast of Yorkshire.
Well, they have their own werewolf there, if I'm not mistaken, right? They have is that the place or another area that Paul investigates where they have like dogman sightings?
Yeah, Bempton. Yeah, Bempton has many dogman sightings, and Flixton and the whole area. If you was to travel...
Flixton, yeah, that's the place.
Flixton, I mean, the one that people know, there's two actually. The one that's got the lore is the Flixton werewolf. And that's been around, I think, the first sighting. This is hundreds of years old, this account. But the sightings have been going on forever and a day, and they're still coming in, these sightings. Then there's the Beast of Barmston Drain, which, from Paul's research, this is the same creature. If this is indeed a creature, if there's more than one. Paul's now of the thinking that this thing's interdimensional, just down to the breeding population, that whole flesh and blood argument thing. And because of the nature of a place like Bempton, much like Winter Hill, Winter Hill's not quite as active, but because you see lots of UFOs and lots of cryptid accounts and ghosts, there's reports of all three of those, and I'm pretty sure that some of those sightings don't belong in the ghost box, if you like. But there's a lot of different phenomena, and that appears to be the case in a few places now. Rendlesham's another place in Britain, that down south of England, that has all those elements to it. You've got that. You've certainly got the cryptids, you've got the UFOs, and you've got the ET phenomena there, where people, you can go into Rendlesham and many people have photographed, look like etheric greys, if you like. There's some amazing photographs that have come out of that place. So that's part of a place. This year, I've been asked to work on a 6-part series, looking at the 6 most prominent places in Britain that have all this phenomena. So these 3, Winter Hill, Bempton, Rendlesham, they're 3 of the places. Another one is the Big Grey Man. I don't know whether you're aware of that. The Big Grey Man is a Bigfoot sighting in Scotland, on the mountains in Scotland. And it's a legend here, certainly in Scotland. Everybody's aware of the Big Grey Man. That's another place. And the 5th place I think we were doing is Loch Ness, because obviously I don't think you can do a show on cryptids in the UK without talking about Loch Ness. And I've got a good friend, Andy McGrath. Have you spoke to Andy McGrath?
Yeah, I've had him on
my
show before.
I thought you had. Yeah, so Andy's a great guy. Andy knows all about you. He's pretty much amongst my colleagues, he's the guy that knows. It's his favourite thing. It's his pet subject, the lake monster. It's not necessarily my thing, but I think it has to go in the pot. You know, when you talk about the activity at Loch Ness, that Crowley was up there in the house he owned opposite Loch Ness, and the conjuring stuff and all the occult stuff going on up there. Cause that's another, sorry, I should have mentioned that. That's the other element to this, the occult connection. So at Bempton, you've got the satanic occult practicing that was going on there. At Winter Hill, we recently found out that there was a coven of witches that were banished from Pendle Hill but Pendle Hill is a, have you heard of the Pendle witch trials here in the UK? That's a huge deal. You know, in the UK, that's a big thing, the Pendle witch trials.
How long ago did that occur?
No, I think it's the 1600s we're talking about. So they were banished apparently to Winter Hill, to a place called Rivington. And we're wondering now, is there a connection with that sort of stuff? I don't know. I certainly think there is an occult connection. And
definitely
certainly
a big time occult connection in Rendlesham for ages.
Yeah.
That's what's been going on there.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because I think in all of these places, you can go walk into these places on any given day and come across some sort of not necessarily black magic, white magic sites, or some sort of ritual has gone on in that location. Now, from what I understand, some people are going there healing the land, and some people are doing the opposite. They're taking advantage of the energy that's in these places. So, yeah, I mean, they're all fascinating places, and I think ufology, in a sense, I don't know whether you watched the show that I did with Steve Merrow. You should get Steve Merrow on your show. He's very much, he works with a guy called Barry Fitzgerald, and they've been connecting all this. They're working on a project called Project Doorway, which links all this phenomena. They call it phenomenology. And it's sort of gone full circle to the work that John Keel was doing back at when that happened, all the Mothman stuff. It wasn't just Mothman. This was every phenomena under the sun was happening there. A lot of it went unreported. And that seems to be the same here. Now, as we talked about earlier, I don't know whether that's because we're looking harder into this stuff or whether it's actually being fueled by other things that are going on the planet and around the planet and dimensionally perhaps. So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly a lot of this stuff going on at the moment. And there are other filmmakers now looking into this, which is great. For me, there's never been enough filmmakers doing this sort of stuff. You know, what happens is with the subject, you'll get the mainstream guys coming in. They'll cherry pick one or two cases, often with the tongue in the cheek. And they'll put it out there, and it won't do the witnesses or the locations any justice at all. On the flip side of that, there are one or two things that have been done. So certainly Ancient Aliens has been looking into Paul's research up at Bempton recently, and the Rudston Monolith and all that sort of stuff. Andrew Collins has shown a huge interest in Paul's work. I mean, it's all good, actually. This is all positive stuff for the world of ufology and cryptozoology, if you want to call it that. I don't know whether this stuff even falls into the world of into the realm of cryptozoology anymore with what people are witnessing. I think this is something else. But yeah, certainly like Skinwalker, all the phenomena that's presenting there and the elements from Skinwalker are in all these other locations. All that's happened is I think Skinwalker's just got a little bit more attention. And I think when you focus your attention into a certain location and a place and many minds come together and do the same, I think it increases the activity, because I think you've said it and other researchers have said it. If you focus your attention on this and on them, they'll focus it back. So, and there is an element of being cautious about how far you push this stuff. I mean, we talk privately about what happened to me when I was making the reptilian film. This is something I won't talk about like publicly, but you and I know what happened with that. And I wasn't expecting that to happen in my house. It wasn't a terrifying experience, but it certainly wasn't normal. So whether that, it didn't feel like a warning, but it was warning enough for me to be cautious about what I was doing. So yeah, a fascinating subject, and only more sightings and witnesses can come from it, because I think what's happened is since we've been looking into these accounts, more researchers that wouldn't touch this stuff before are now looking at it, which, all right, some of them are cashing in. That doesn't bother me one bit. As long as they're getting the information out, that's all that concerns me. And certainly the witnesses, if you know, because it must be, I've always thought this, it must be very difficult as a witness to have to talk about something like that. You know, you've experienced that, James. You know what that's like, to have to talk about these things and have just people look at you like you're, you know, what planet are you on? You know, and that's the sort of sense now. You can actually see the relief on the faces when they're offloading this information to you. And I see it in other researchers' work when they're in conversing with people that have seen something out of this world. They're sort of like the you can feel the shoulders go down. It's sort of like they've just got it off and someone's willing to listen. Someone's even seen the same thing. So I think for what's going on in the world of ufology, all right, there's a lot of negativity in there still, and there's a lot of misdirection in there still. But that's always been the case. You all know that. That's always been the case. We just got to navigate around that stuff and, you know, and deal with it in the right way.
And some of the places you described are vortex ridden places, quite frankly. Benton and other places. Winter Hill, is that what you call it? The place that you described. What's that place near you? What's it called again?
Yeah, it's called Winter Hill. The place Winter Hill. Is called Winter Hill. Paul researches Benton, and I think you're right. I think I'm going to try and meet up with Maria Wheatley later on this year. She's a lady that does a lot of research down at Stonehenge, and she does a lot of lane line work. Her dad was.
Thinking about it. You know, all the confluences of all these lane lines. They're just everywhere in the UK.
Yeah, and I think you and I, we've got a friend in Ellis Taylor. He's another guy that he's doing some fascinating work into the dragon lines that he's looking into. So I've got to speak to Alice about that. And I think there's certainly connections to be made. And I think that the powers that be are certainly well aware of these ancient connections, which is why there's been occult practices on these places for thousands of years. I don't think that's any coincidence that the military bases are also built on these.
Yes, they tend to places. Be smack dab on top of these vortex centers.
Many of the nodal points on these ley lines. Yes. Yeah, where they're using and utilizing the, you know, sometimes positive energy. So, well, it's powerful energy, whatever it is, and whatever its source is, they're certainly manipulating that.
They park themselves above a place. Those with the more of an esoteric mindset in the know, and they use it as a power source. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the veils are thinning, and I think that this ties in with the rollout of, you know, enhanced bandwidth, let's call it, right? That's already in the process. I think as time goes on, we're going to see even more rents and tears, if you will, in the fabric of space-time, we're going to see even more cryptid activity. We're going to see even more UFO activity. Alex Colliers want to say that we're going to see a level of, I'm paraphrasing it, a level of high strangeness that's going to be through the roof. But anyway, we've had a fascinating first segment with our guest, Chris Turner. Chris, could you let our viewers and listeners know how they can find your channel and your websites and how they can contribute to your essential work?
Yeah, I mean, you can find me on YouTube. The YouTube channel is called Chris Turner Films. You can find me on Facebook. You can find there's many of the Facebook pages that I've got is Don't Mention the Reptilians. If that's your thing and you're into reptilians, you can like that page. There's an elusive page for the cryptid stuff. Obviously I've started The Last Transmission, that podcast, which is on my YouTube channel. And probably Facebook. I'm always around. I try not to be on there too much, but I get a lot of witness reports through Facebook. So I have to be part of that. It would be silly not to. You can find me, and any help and advice, or I'm always open to taking advice and, you know, sources of information. I get all sorts of emails. I've had some just this morning, woke up to a fascinating email about some encounters here in the UK and what may be contributing to it. So, yeah, I'm open to it, and feel free to contact me.
And to our viewers and listeners, if you like what we do, if you believe what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.